Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. Launched at Christmas in 2021, the James Webb Space Telescope has proved to be the gift that keeps on giving for astronomers around the world. Much more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope, the Webb operates in the infrared spectrum and has delivered images of stunning clarity of objects from our solar system to the furthest reaches of space and time. Its performance has been remarkable, and the science it's producing is truly out of this world. Later on in the show, we'll hear from NASA Webb Project Scientist for Operations Nicole Colon to talk about Webb's studies of exoplanets and more. And then we'll hear from Project Scientist and Deputy Project Director Macarena Garcia Marin for an overview of the deep field and galactic observations that Webb has been making. But first, for an overview of the telescope and its operations during the past 3 years, we're joined by Mike Davis. Mike is the NASA Project Manager for the James Webb Space Telescope, and he joins us now from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Mike Davis, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Being the boss of one of the greatest scientific experiments of all time, you know, that's got to feel kind of cool to go home and think about what you do every day.
Yeah, this is one of the few times when my kids look at me and say, yeah, Dad, you got a cool job. So that's pretty cool.
Tell us a bit about how you came to that position, a little bit of your background and previous experiences that brought you here.
Well, I started out, I graduated with an astronomy degree from Villanova in 1982 and took a job right out of college at Lockheed, where I worked on a variety of telescope-type projects, the Advanced X-ray Astrophysics Facility, which became Chandra, and then eventually on a couple of weather satellites. And then I transferred to Goddard to work on the Hubble Space Telescope mission back in 1999. And I worked Hubble for 4 years, including two servicing missions. And then I transferred to Ball Aerospace to work on the Webb Telescope project. And then I became a civil servant working for Goddard directly on the Webb project back in 2011. And then I started out as a mission systems engineer, which is basically just systems engineering related topics on the project, became the deputy mission systems engineer, and eventually I became the operations project manager that I am now, and I've been in the position, it'll be a year in August.
Very cool. Well, for our listeners, tell us briefly, what does an operations project manager actually do?
Number one is that you interface with the program personnel at headquarters. They're basically my boss, as well as the directorate folks here at Goddard, the Flight Projects Directorate. So they're my immediate boss who I report to on a day-to-day basis. But then there's the headquarters personnel as well. Among the project folks here at Goddard, I keep them informed as to everything that's going on with the project. You're responsible for budgets and everything. But you're also responsible for when there's a hiccup with the telescope, what we call an anomaly. We have these anomaly management boards where we review what has happened and what is the path forward. And I'm like the final approval authority on the path forward, so that way they can recover normal operations in that case.
And Webb has a really interesting orbit. And for our folks that aren't quite familiar with how that works, could you tell us just a bit about where it is and why it's there?
Yes. Contrary to the Hubble Space Telescope, which orbits about 325 miles above the Earth, Webb was actually installed in an orbit around what is called the L2 point. And there's 5 points, and they're named after the mathematician Lagrange. And they're points in space where if you were to position an object at that point, you stay relatively stable there. You don't tend to wander off too far. And it's a gravitationally stable point. Now, why it's useful for observations like Webb is that it's a million miles away from the Earth. So Webb observes in the infrared. So we're absorbing heat radiation from very faint objects. So the Earth, when you're orbiting close to the Earth like Hubble, the Earth occupies a good part of your field of view and generates a lot of heat. So that would contaminate your observations. So what you do is you put the telescope out at this L2 point. It's relatively stable, but it's also cold because you're a million miles away from Earth. So it enhances your science productivity.
And the spacecraft's been in operations for 3 years now. One of the things that just kind of was just so amazing when I've watched it launch and deploy was I think everybody was kind of on the edge of their seats hoping that nothing would go wrong. So it was a very complex operation to deploy this telescope, and it all went so very well. How has the spacecraft performed and the telescope performed, you know, from your point of view for the past 3 years?
Actually, I think the telescope has performed better than I think most of us had thought. Back in October of 22, I was invited to give a talk on the Webb telescope at my daughter's college. And the title of the talk was JWST Works Perfectly. And at that time, we were working quite well, just minor hiccups. And we haven't had anything major to speak of. Technically, if you were to summarize Webb's performance, it's performing better than predicted and better than we thought. It is actually, we had propellant, for example, we used propellant to maintain our position around the L2 point. And that propellant was sized to allow us to operate for 11 and a half years on orbit. And yet the launch accuracy provided by the Europeans when they launched us was so accurate, and our propellant use has been so minor that rather than a propellant for 11 years, we have propellant that could take us out to be between 2045 and 2063,
wow,
depending upon our propellant usage. Our what we call wavefront error, which basically is how well the telescope is focused, is actually a factor of 2 better than required. Our imaging performance has been so good that we can observe an object in a matter of a few hours that would take the Hubble telescope hours to days, if not weeks, to generate.
Wow, that is truly amazing. And when you mentioned the name of your talk at your daughter's college, it made me go, uh-oh. Whenever I say things like that, something bad always happens right afterwards. But have you had any kind of glitches that had you, you know, thinking, uh-oh, where you really had to deal with some kind of problems? Because spacecraft are, you know, can be finicky.
Yeah, we expected problems out of the gate because the telescope is so complex. And although we had practiced with simulations at the Mission Operations Center at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, which is responsible for mission and science operations for the Webb telescope, nothing can prepare you for the real thing in orbit. It's basically like we're learning how to drive this humongous car. And yeah, we had some problems out of the gates. The telescope was a little finicky. We had several occurrences where we would trip what we call into safe mode, where the telescope isn't operating, it's just maintaining a safe state to give us the time to diagnose the problem, fix it, address it, and then resume operations. We have worked out a lot of those kinks. A lot of those kinks have been resolved with software patches where you update the software that's on the vehicle itself, such that these things, if they happen again, we have the power basically to drive through it because we're basically telling the telescope, oh, it's okay, this has happened before, we're okay, you can continue. So those are the types of things that we have done to observe more efficiently and more effectively and minimize the telescope downtime. And it's the type of thing that you expect early on in the mission too. It's sort of like a bathtub curve where you have hiccups early in the mission and then they drop and you have this long period where you're performing very effectively with no real hiccups. And then as the components start to age, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, you start having, you know, electronics type of issues or maybe mechanical type of issues. But we haven't been up there long enough to really encounter any of these types of issues. So we are at the peak of our curve now in terms of operational efficiency.
And I would imagine when you do get to that point where those kinds of things start to happen, you have operational workarounds, you know, where you can, you know, redundancies in systems and things like that.
Yes, all of our boxes are redundant, sometimes once over, sometimes two or three times over. So we have redundancies, we have contingency procedures, we have all sorts of different ways to allow us to implement the workarounds necessary to recover the operations.
Can you give us a sense of what a workhorse James Webb Space Telescope is? Like what its schedule is like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Give us a sense of how much work it does.
Webb is observing roughly 82% of the day. The rest of the 18% is spent going from slewing from one target to the next, or maybe just scheduled downtime while it's reconfiguring or conducting other types of housekeeping operations that aren't conducive to observations. So in 24 hours of a day, Webb is gathering data roughly 80%, slightly more than 80% of the day. So that's what, about 21 hours out of 24 hours. A telescope like Hubble, which orbits the Earth, because it's orbiting Earth and the Earth field, you know, occupies a good chunk of its field of view, Hubble is only achieving 30 to 45% viewing efficiency. So because of our L2 points and the nature of the Webb observations, we're observing, you know, nearly twice as much time on target time as a Hubble telescope can achieve.
Yeah, more time and more efficiently. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all around the world, there are astronomers, astrophysicists that are wanting to do observations or using this data. Could you give us a sense of the scope and scale of the number of observers and scientists that actually use this incredible data?
Every year, we put out what we call a call for proposals. So we break a year's worth of observations into what we call a cycle. So we are currently getting ready. We're about 3/4 of the way through cycle 3 and getting ready to commence cycle 4 in the July-August timeframe. So we put out a cycle for observations. We identify how many hours of telescope time will be approximately allowed for the observers, and it's based on your observation efficiency. So for cycle 4, we got requests for 8 times as much telescope time as we plan to be able to observe. So that's how popular and how eager the science community is to use the Webb telescope.
We've all been just amazed by some of the incredible images over the last 3 years that the James Webb has produced, and the really interesting science. Of course, recently it was in the news that the possible detection of some molecules that could indicate life processes on an exoplanet. Sounds like the scientific jury is still kind of out on that one. But for you personally, as an astronomer too, do you have any, you know, and this is probably a difficult question, like asking you to name your favorite kid, but do you have any like favorite James Webb observations, pictures, moments that you'd like to share with us?
I think the obvious answer would be, gee, I'm impressed by all of them because I'm the ops manager here at Goddard. It's not one picture that stands out. It's the fact that what I think has surprised me surprised a lot of people. No matter where Webb points and looks, it sees something. You know, you go outside at night and you look at the sky and you can see dark spots in between the stars. Even the Hubble telescope can stare at a patch and spot in space and see just a smattering of stars, but that's all that it'll see, maybe a couple of galaxies. But whenever Webb looks anywhere, it sees thousands of galaxies that heretofore have never been seen before. And it's not just, well, it's because we looked in one spot of space. It's wherever we look, we see something that we didn't expect to see. There's no empty space wherever Webb looks. It sees something. And I think that is the most mind-boggling thing. And you have to realize that Webb's field of view is small. It's like looking through a straw into space and seeing thousands of objects within that field of view. It's just amazing.
Wow. It reminds me of the first time I saw the Hubble Deep Field of the famous image of the galaxies, to think that, you know, James Webb sees that wherever it looks, huh?
Right. Exactly.
As somebody that grew up in the space age, I'm 65 now, lived through the glory days of Apollo and enjoyed the Hubble Space Telescope. And when I was a kid, I used to love to go up to Mount Palomar to see the Hale Telescope, which was the largest telescope in the world at that time. And of all of the scientific instruments I've encountered in my lifetime, this one is truly the champ.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's just mind-boggling what Webb has done, and yet probably the best is yet to come, because what we're getting to the point now is that we're able to define observations based on observations that we've taken. So we're asking the next question, and that's really where you get the big discoveries, because you've only scratched the surface now. But, you know, imagine what Webb could be doing if it's as fortunate as Hubble to be able to operate for another 30 years. Just imagine what Webb will be able to do.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Well, Mike Davis, Operations Project Manager for the James Webb Space Telescope, thanks for joining us and sharing your obvious passion and pride in this, you know, wonderful instrument.
Well, thank you very much. I was happy to be here.
Thanks to our guest, NASA James Webb Space Telescope Project Director Mike Davis. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the James Webb Space Telescope with project scientists involved in the observations and science being collected by the Deep Space Telescope. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We're now joined by Nicole Colon. Nicole Colon is the NASA James Webb Space Telescope Project Scientist for Operations and an astrophysicist who specializes in observations of exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system. Nicole Colon, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
Can you explain to us a bit about your actual job? What does the Operations Project Scientist do?
Sure. You know, it's interesting because it kind of encompasses all science operations of the observatory, which is a lot. So I provide oversight of everything that's going on from a scientific perspective. So we use the observatory to study, you know, everything from nearby comets in our solar system to, you know, other stars in our galaxy to the most distant galaxies beyond, you know, in the early universe. But in each of these observations, it involves a lot of planning and scheduling and making sure the observatory is working efficiently and collecting, you know, the best quality data it can. And, you know, with four different science instruments and cameras and spectrographs and getting different sensitivities. And so it's a lot of there's a lot of operations behind the scenes, you know, to make the science happen. And so I provide oversight of all these activities just to ensure that basically the observatory is operating well, but also, you know, efficiently and just executing beautifully.
And I would imagine for astrophysicists around the world wanting to use the James Webb Space Telescope, that, you know, the demand probably outstrips the supply you have. So it must be an interesting balancing act to be able to, you know, meet the needs of all those different observing programs. Because like you said, that the Webb studies everything from objects near us in our solar system to the most distant objects ever imaged.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We have way more proposals to use the observatory than we can accommodate. So the current, what we call oversubscription rate, is 9 to 1. So that means, yeah, for every, you know, 9 astronomers or teams of astronomers that request time on this observatory, only one team will be awarded time. You know, again, part of my job is to say, okay, are we, you know, how much science are we able to fit in within the year, right? And so can we continue to add to that and enable, you know, just a few more teams to get data each year, like trying to improve the opportunities for everyone to use the data, right?
Could you delve into the specifics of what makes James Webb so uniquely capable when it comes to studying and characterizing these exoplanets? Because, you know, Kepler could tell us, yeah, there's a planet there and give us some notion of its size. But you can do a lot of interesting things with the James Webb Space Telescope. In fact, there was, you know, a story recently where detecting molecules that could be signs of life, things like that. Could you talk a bit about how it's just a very unique instrument in like studying exoplanets?
Absolutely. It's in general, you know, not just for exoplanets, right? But it's the largest, most powerful telescope NASA has ever launched. And so that in of itself means, you know, the power means you have a lot of sensitivity. You're able to take like higher resolution images than previous observatories. You can reach down to higher sensitivities on different scales than you could before. And that really matters, at least, you know, again, we're talking about exoplanets here, in the regime where we're looking for signals from atmospheres that are on order of like tens of parts per million, like they're, you know, fractions of a percent signals that we're looking for when we're trying to measure whether an atmosphere has something like water in absorption. And so with that level of signal, you know, you need a very sensitive, powerful observatory. And so the Webb telescope is really just a workhorse because of its size and the instrument capabilities, but also its stability is really essential. We can stare at a star and basically see the effect the planet has on the star over hours timescales. And that stability also helps us understand the atmosphere of the planet because we know that the signal we're seeing is not attributed to some motion on the telescope, let's say, you know.
And of course, everybody, you know, wants to hear about the discovery that there's life on another world. And it's, you can say that there's a good possibility or, you know, there's signs of that, but it's kind of hard to just say, yeah, we've definitely detected, you know, life on another planet. But it is interesting to think about Webb being able to look at those atmospheres and detect molecules that are signatures of living things, at least on our planet. Like, for example, oxygen in our atmospheres, it's created by living things. That's why it's there.
That's right. You know, it's something I like to remind folks too, is that, you know, Webb was never designed to find signatures really on small planets in general, you know, like much less biosignatures is what we call evidence of life or you know, signs that there could be life on a planet. But that's really what showcases Webb's sensitivity and power, is that we can look at all sizes of exoplanets. We can look for their atmospheres. A lot of times what we're doing is firstly just trying to detect if there's an atmosphere at all. And that's something that is a really important first step, especially for planets that are like the size of Earth. You know, again, these things are light years away, which is, you know, really trillions of miles away. And we're able to firstly say if they have an atmosphere at all, in the sense of, does the planet appear larger than expected at the wavelengths of light we're looking at? And then secondarily, we can keep pushing, you know, on observations to say, okay, so now is there something like water, which contains oxygen, like you brought up, right? Or are there other potential molecules or elements in the atmosphere? And so these are things that we're starting to get evidence of. A lot of it is very preliminary when we're looking at the small planets. And, you know, I have to say a big part of the challenge is actually the stars we're observing. The stars are more active than the sun usually. So we have solar flares, we have, you know, spots on the sun. Those same things happen on other stars. And they can happen more frequently. And so that is a direct impact on when we're looking with JWST at these exoplanet atmospheres. We can see the effects of the stars, and that's been an actual challenge to remove. Yeah.
And could you just characterize, you know, some of the highlights for you? What are some of the things you've really enjoyed seeing come out of the James Webb Space Telescope the last couple of years?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I really appreciate just how beautiful the data is, both the image data, but then what we call the spectroscopic quality data. But then with exoplanets, just incredible at how things are jumping out at us. Whenever we look at a different exoplanet, it looks like we're seeing something new. And not something new in the sense that we hadn't predicted it, but something new that it's very easily detected. Like we saw the first evidence or direct detection, I should say, of carbon dioxide. And that was very much speculated that we would see, but we did not get definitive evidence or detection until JWST looked at exoplanets. And carbon dioxide is just, you know, again, that contains that oxygen that we're looking for, you know, in the carbon. So now we are finding that in a lot of planets, which is fascinating. And then also other things like sulfur dioxide as well jumped out at us, which was incredible because that indicates evidence of what's called photochemistry. And that's a process that we see in our atmosphere where the sun is impacting the chemistry of the atmosphere. So now we're, you know, just seeing things that we literally weren't able to before without the resolution and wavelength coverage of this, the Webb telescope.
And when you like talk to your friends, family, I imagine you do a lot of public speaking and in outreach engagement. What are some of the common misconceptions people seem to have about the James Webb Space Telescope? Do you run into that at all?
Yeah, you know, a lot of them know, at least have heard of it first. That's always the first hurdle. It's making sure that they've heard of it. You know, because with NASA, there's a lot of activity, you know, missions across all range of science, right? And not to mention human spaceflight. And so first hurdle is always, have you heard of Webb? You know, and thankfully they have. Often people think that Webb has replaced Hubble. That's one of the main conceptions that I like to point out is not accurate, because really Hubble is up there, just celebrated its 35th launch anniversary, and it's continuing to do amazing science. And it's really important that it's still operating, because Hubble covers a different wavelength space than JWST. So together we get that full picture where we wouldn't have it, you know, we have like pieces of the picture with each observatory, you know, but in order to get especially like the ultraviolet angle with Hubble, and then with Webb, we get the infrared angle, and you can put that together and just understand more about whatever planet, galaxy, you know, star you're looking at. And so that's actually one of the main kind of misconceptions that I have to address is, you know, Hubble's up there and it's doing great, but Webb did not replace it, right?
Yeah, and sometimes they even work together as a team.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know one of my favorite misconceptions from Hubble, at least, was when I would talk to people that, you know, and I'd ask them, well, why do you think it's important to put, you know, a telescope in outer space? Well, because they could be closer, you know, to what they're looking at. It's like, no, that's not quite it. That'd be kind of like me stepping out on my front porch and saying, I'm closer to the San Francisco 49ers stadium here. And then I go to the back porch and say, now I'm closer to the Philadelphia Eagles stadium.
Oh, dear. Your favorite.
Yep. Misconceptions. What do you enjoy most about your work there? Because it just must be fascinating. Every day there's got to be something new going on. What's the most rewarding part of your work with the James Webb Space Telescope for you?
You know, I think it's hard to pick one. So with any mission, but including, I mean, especially now with this one, you know, basically every day there's, I don't even know how to keep track of how many, you know, new science papers come out. And like, I literally cannot keep up with the science results coming out of the observatory. So that's always, you know, a fun challenge to try to keep up and learn. But I think it's really often just engaging with the community who uses the observatory that is really special, because, you know, they are oftentimes, well, including myself, you know, programs I'm involved in, you know, we are the first people looking at some of these objects, you know, with this observatory for the first time. And so we're seeing things, new information, like constantly for the first time. And that's a lot of firsts, you know, that you can have that just, it's kind of overwhelming, but in a good way, you know, like you want to make sure that you're always kind of at the forefront of science and, you know, pushing new results and following up current results. And that's something else that now we're, you know, about 3 years of science operations into the mission. And so we're already at the level where the Webb telescope is following up things that's discovered, you know, in its first year, let's say. And so now Webb is following up its own discoveries, and that it's exciting because you're like, well, okay, now what are you going to learn from the follow-up? Because you're pushing, you know, to the next level, right? So every time you just keep pushing every day.
Yes. And it's the amazing thing about the scientific, you know, discovery, especially when you're using an instrument so capable, is that, you know, the latest observations, those lead to new questions, and then those new questions lead to further observations. And it's just this incredible ongoing chain of discovery.
It is. And that's not to say, you know, that we don't, like we're always discovering, but we're also making conclusions. You know, it's not that we are just having endless questions, right? We
yeah, but that's how you learn. Yeah. That's how, you know, you just like you find out what you don't know, and then you learn about that, and then it's like, but you'll that's the joy of science, is there's no knowing everything. There's always something new to learn.
That's right. Yes.
Well, Nicole Colon, operations project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope, thanks for joining us and sharing your passion and expertise, and best of luck with, you know, ongoing discoveries and incredible science coming out of the James Webb.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to our guest, NASA Webb Project Scientist for Operations, Nicole Colon. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at the magnificent astronomical observations that have been made by the James Webb Space Telescope during the past 3 years. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our next guest is Macarena Garcia Marin. Macarena is a European Space Agency astronomer and Webb Project Scientist and Deputy Project Director at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. She joins us now to talk about the incredible observations the Webb's been making of galaxies at the farthest reaches of space and time in our universe. Macarena Garcia Marin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much, Dave. Very nice being here.
I'd like to know a little bit about you, you know, coming from the ESA perspective. But tell me about your background and how you first got interested in astronomy and the path that led you to the James Webb Space Telescope. Because everybody always has an interesting origin story. I find especially with astronomers and astrophysicists.
Well, mine, I think it's pretty straightforward. So I am from Spain. And I was born in the Canary Islands, you know, a very small group of islands in the Atlantic Ocean. And we have beautiful night skies and we have astronomical observatories. So that's what got me started as a child to really be interested in space and science and looking at the night sky. And I have to say also Carl Sagan's Cosmos series was a big influence for me as well. So that's childhood origin. Then I studied in the Canary Islands and I went to Madrid in the mainland in Spain to do my PhD, my doctorate. My PhD supervisor, he was the Spanish copy for the MIRI instrument on board of the James Webb. And then a significant component of my PhD was doing things for MIRI. Back then it was simulating how MIRI will observe high redshift galaxies. And now we get to do that. So that's really cool. So after my PhD, I officially joined the MIRI team, moved to Germany, started working on the MIRI integration, testing. And then I was lucky enough to get hired by the European Space Agency to come and work at the Space Telescope and Science Institute. And here I am.
And I love the fact that Carl Sagan's Cosmos was inspirational to you, because I've heard that story many, many times. And knowing Carl's family and how he felt about, especially women in science and women in astronomy, he would be happy to hear that if he was around today.
I wish it was.
Yes, me too. You've mentioned MIRI a few times, but let's get into what MIRI is, because for a lot of our listeners, they may not be aware of, you know, what is MIRI? What is a mid-infrared instrument? Explain what it is and why it's important for the James Webb Space Telescope.
Yes. So the entire telescope observes in the infrared as a broad statement. And the infrared is the type of light that we don't see with our own eyes, but that is really, really good to measure temperature of objects. That means that it's very good to measure really cold objects, anything emits on the infrared, but also very cold things. So you can see them glowing in the infrared. You can see things like cold dust, cold ices. You can also see what's behind that dust, because the dust absorbs light that is emitted in the visible and re-emits it in the infrared. And so on Webb, we have three instruments that look at the near infrared, slightly closer to the visible light, slightly redder. And MIRI is the only one that looks into the mid-infrared. So with that, you can look at even redder objects. They are colder. You can go deeper into the dust, and you can see really different parts and aspects of that object. MIRI being the only instrument working on the mid-infrared, it does imaging and it does spectroscopy in different ways. So it's a really, I am probably biased because I work for MIRI for many years, but I think in many areas it is being a fundamental tool to determine and to really understand astronomical objects. It's really making a difference.
Well, since the James Webb Space Telescope has been in operations for the last 3 years, it's made some just amazing observations and discoveries, especially about the early universe.
Oh yeah.
And I'd like you to go into a little more depth on, you know, what are some of the things that you as an astrophysicist are interested in, and what are some of the things that Webb is uncovering that are new and interesting about the most distant objects that we can image with that amazing machine, which are also, you know, conversely, the farthest back in time that we can see.
Yes. And actually, that was one of the primary objectives of scientific objectives of this observatory, to observe the very first galaxies and very first stars. And to do that, you need a telescope that is big, like Webb, and that observes in the infrared. And that is because the light that was emitted by those very old objects in the visible light has to travel towards us, both in space and time. And it does that in a universe that expands. So in that sort of expansion, the light, being a wave, gets stretched like a slinky, and it moves from the visible to the infrared. So you do need an infrared machine to observe them. JWST has been absolutely incredible for even 3 years into operations for observing the early universe. We are seeing a time of the universe that we have never seen before, because we had seen the cosmic microwave background with some other observatories, and we had seen objects that were younger, but never that portion of the universe. So we're really rediscovering the first billion years of the universe. And what we're finding is that galaxies are more numerous than we expected. They are more massive. They are, some of them, better arranged and really have structures that, like spiral arms and really organized structures that we have never seen before at that period of time. And it has allowed us to see that galaxies were already in place as early as 290 million years after the Big Bang. And that sounds like a lot of time, but in a universe that is about 3.8 billion years old, it's a really infant universe. And there's one particular galaxy that is the oldest we have confirmed spectroscopically, that is decomposing its light and finding like it's the fingerprint, like the DNA of that galaxy to confirm the distance. So we know that that particular galaxy that has a very long and not appealing name is was in place about 290 million years after the Big Bang. Not only that, but we also know that it already has had enough time to have some generations of stars that haven't reached the environment. So I think when it comes to the early universe, we are learning a lot, but actually we are also opening very many, many, many questions, because now we need to probably revise some models and understanding how is it possible that these galaxies that seem to be so big, well, not big in size, massive. They are not that big in size, but they are very massive, they are very bright, and they are in a universe that is really young. So how did they got theirs? And now there are many programs that are studying exactly that.
And are there any kind of new ideas blossoming around this to try to explain this? Because from my understanding, you know, we didn't expect to see galaxies that far back in time, like you said, in characterizing this earliest one. Are there some, you know, kind of, is this leading to some interesting ideas about, you know, how could this be? Because I would think that that's a mystery you really want to try to unravel.
Certainly. And I think it's leading to definitely many ideas and revising what we know and what we think about how the universe began to be at the beginning. I think as of now, we have more questions than answers, but the ideas that are being in place that are these galaxies, maybe they formed so quickly and so early and they are so massive because back in that time, the stars, many, many stars were formed that were really massive, incredibly massive, because the universe was more pristine than it is now. And so it could form bigger, incredibly massive stars that would evolve very rapidly and create this sort of enriched early galaxies. It could also be early black holes that were very massive and that were created early and gave that mass to the galaxies. Some people have been looking into alternative theories to the, you know, Big Bang and the Lambda CDM, the cold dark matter explanation of the universe. So I think there are many, many groups who are now investigating and exploring all these ideas. Personally, I have not seen any evidence that disproves the Big Bang theory, if you want, just to keep it in those terms.
To back up there for a moment, from your point of view, there's nothing that you've discovered that contradicts the Big Bang theory, you know, our standard model of the universe?
No, I don't think we have evidence of that yet, that is robust. There are certainly investigations going into that direction and some alternative, there are alternative ways of explaining the universe where you would end up with different ages and different ways of creating it. But I think we have to be very careful before disproving the Big Bang theory because we still have a lot of observational evidence that backs it up. I think it's more a matter of understanding the biases of our own observations. For instance, even with Webb, when you look at that early universe, we're only seeing probably the biggest and most massive galaxies. Probably there are more there, but we just don't see them. So I think we need to understand all those biases and also the biases in theories, because many of these observations, then you have to back them up with models. And these models are subject to, often they were developed based on the nearby universe and not the very high-received universe. So they may have to be revised to slightly change. Sometimes we're talking about slight changes that would fit the data better, but that would not really fundamentally change any of our current more common understanding of the origin or formation of the universe.
Well, to me, there's just nothing more mysterious than the actual origin of the universe.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just one of those most fundamental questions. How did it all come to be? Yes. And that's kind of the joy of, you know, what you do and unraveling some of these mysterious things and making observations that make us question, okay, well, you know, we probably don't have it completely right. It doesn't mean it's completely wrong. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there's probably some fundamental things that we just don't quite know yet that but maybe now we're on the right track.
Absolutely. And I think that's a beauty of this, because we are exploring things we've never looked at before. And you're absolutely right, that means that you may have to revise some of your models and some of your conceptions and maybe how the stars were formed initially, all of those, and when. So all of those have to be revised. And I think that applies when it comes to web. I think the revision of the models and the theories, it is happening across the board, because you're, in a way, faced with a wealth of new data at a level of detail and sensitivity you had never had before. So that means that probably your models are essentially not good enough. You have to revise them, and you have to make them good enough to actually fit and understand the data you are taking. That's on one side. On the other side, you have to be very careful with how you treat and study and analyze your data and interpret it. And so it goes in both directions, I think. But yes, the beauty of this is that there are many, many questions that we don't have the answer to.
When you talk to your friends and family and people, perhaps in the public, when you're doing some kind of public outreach, what are some of the interesting questions you get asked? Maybe misconceptions or just interesting questions that folks have that you have to answer about the James Webb Space Telescope?
Many of them. I particularly love questions from children, because they are so out of the box. I remember one public talk, this was in a school, we're talking about supernova and you know, active galactic nuclei and all those sort of eye-catching explosive mechanisms. And so there was this kid asking me essentially, so is that going to affect us? That supernova that exploded, I don't know how many years ago, and that is incredibly far away, is that going to affect me? Because they don't have they were learning the idea of distance and time travel and all of that. I remember one gentleman once asked me, he was an engineer, and he was asking me about the beryllium that the mirrors are made of. And he was curious to know if they were affected by magnetic fields of, you know, perhaps some solar activity. So I did find that a very interesting question, because it was going into the nitty-gritty detail of the composition of a mirror. And the answer was no, by the way. This is very specific, pure beryllium, and it is not affected by that. But anything that is a little bit different, I find it really interesting.
It must be a thrill for you after all these years to be doing what you're doing and seeing this all unfold with this marvelous instrument, you know, which I'm referring to often as, I think it's one of the greatest scientific instruments in the history of humanity. For you personally, what's the most fun and interesting part of your job? What do you enjoy most?
So many things. Webb is very much a team effort. It has been always an international collaboration, of course, led by NASA, but with the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, many, many industries, universities, many countries in Europe, US, Canada. And I do love that aspect of collaboration. And I have to say the Webb team, it's been always an excellent team, not only from the technical and knowledgeable part, because, you know, so many smart people working on it, but also from the human aspect of it. Everybody is just great. So at a very personal level, I have always very much enjoyed that team effort and that collaborative approach that we have always had with Webb. At day-to-day, I do really like working with data. And I do like working, you know, on my own data, but also treating little aspects of the data to improve them and make it so it is a beautiful spectra or a beautiful image at the end. I like that. I also do enjoy public outreach. I think it's really important to bring the message of the science out to the community, because this is a telescope for everyone and for everyone to enjoy and to really see the fruits of so many years of development.
Well, Macarena Garcia Marin, it's been a joy to talk to you about the James Webb Space Telescope. Thanks for sharing your passion and your expertise and also your childhood story of growing up in the Canary Islands. As soon as you said that, my immediate thought was, oh, the observatories are there. That's, yes. Must have been an awesome place as a kid to see the stars.
It really is. Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, NASA James Webb Space Telescope Project Director Mike Davis, NASA Webb Project Scientist for Operations Nicole Colon, and Webb Project Scientist and Deputy Project Director, European Space Agency Astronomer Macarena Garcia Marin. You can learn more about the telescope and see the incredible images it's capturing at science.nasa.gov/mission/web. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.